This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Father Pierre Bazile says that he was just 12 years of age when he knew he wanted to live a religious life. And today he's been living in a silent monastery for 45 years. Hear his story.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. And let's head first to the Middle East, because within the next few hours we are expecting to hear new details on exactly which Israeli hostages will be released next as part of the Gaza ceasefire deal with Hamas. It is hoped the hostages will be released tomorrow, and a number of Palestinian prisoners are also due to be freed. It's all happening as the ceasefire holds in Gaza, which has enabled thousands of Palestinians to return to their home neighbourhoods. But as we'll hear in a moment, many of them are nothing but rubble. First, let's cross live to Jerusalem to the BBC's Nick Beek, who's on the line. Nick, first of all, tell us what's expected today, and are we on schedule?
Rebecca, we're still waiting for the names of the four hostages who Hamas say they'll release. The details will be announced by Qatar, which has been acting as a mediator with Hamas. We don't have specifics, but it is thought that all four of the hostages are women, both soldiers and at least one civilian. And the plan is that these hostages will be freed, and then hours later, a number of Palestinian prisoners, the figure being bandied about is about 180. They are currently in Israeli prisons and they will be released. Now, it's worth pointing out, in the first exchange that took place successfully last weekend, those released from Israeli jails were women and children. This time, the prisoners are in a more serious category. They include some people who've been serving sentences of more than 15 years, some of them convicted for murder. So, as I say, this is the outline of what we expect, but we're still waiting for the details.
And in terms of the ceasefire, it's nearly a week now that it's been in place. It seems to be holding broadly, doesn't it? Do we know much about the law and order situation in the Gaza Strip, and particularly with all these aid trucks now coming in, has that seen any difficulty with those coming in?
You are right, it is holding. It's now the sixth day, but it is by nature a fragile situation. On the ground, aid agencies are saying that the security situation has improved a lot, and they put that down to local police being back on the streets. Worth pointing out, these police are actually Hamas officers. So they had withdrawn months ago after the Israelis started to target them, but it seems they are now back on the streets. When they withdrew previously, it created this power vacuum, really. And we saw the emergence of criminal gangs in Gaza, and they were often looting the aid supplies coming in. So we hear that security has improved, but at the same time, I guess Hamas is demonstrating that it hasn't been destroyed, that it's not going away. And that was absolutely a key aim set out by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the start of this war, after the October 7th attacks, to destroy Hamas. And that is why his critics, including those in his own government, say they're opposed to this ceasefire deal.
We'll have more on the aid situation in a moment, but just briefly while we've got you, Nick, there's news just in that the Israelis are extending their deadline for withdrawing from Lebanon. What's that all about?
That's right. So this is another ceasefire that has held over the past 2 months. It was agreed at the end of November. That stopped the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, based in Lebanon. As part of this deal, after 60 days, all the Israeli troops were to leave. That deadline comes this weekend, and in the past hour, we've had a statement from the office of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and they're saying basically it won't happen. And the Israelis are blaming the Lebanese authorities, saying that they haven't enforced the deal, and so that the withdrawal of Israeli troops will continue going beyond this deadline, and the Israelis say that they'll coordinate with the new US Trump administration. So That's what's happening now. And of course, we don't know, crucially, Rebecca, how Hezbollah will respond to this. Previously, they've said any extension would be absolutely unacceptable.
All right, for the moment, thank you very much indeed for joining us live. That's the BBC's Nick Beak in Jerusalem. Well, the Hamas-run health authorities in Gaza say that more than 10,000 people are still missing in the rubble of bombed-out buildings. Since the ceasefire came into effect last Sunday, teams of rescuers have been fanning out across the Gaza Strip to search for the dead and many killed by Israeli airstrikes. The Israeli government has banned the BBC and other international news organisations from entering Gaza to report independently, but with the help of trusted local journalists in Gaza, the BBC's Fergal Keane in Jerusalem has sent this report on that search for the missing, and I should warn you, it's a distressing listen.
They work with their hands, a piece of rubble at a time, dust rising around them. Shreds of clothing are pulled out, bones tumble free, a skull is found. Teeth, fragments of broken humanity, to which the searchers seek to give a name. Often, though, they must write the Arabic word marjul, unidentified, on the white body bags. Osama Salah lives in Rafah and returned home to find the remains of a war victim in his house.
I swear, it is a painful feeling. I cried. We are humans with feeling, seeing people torn. I can't convey to you how miserable the tragedy is.
The remains are taken to hospitals where families can come and check. In the courtyard of the European hospital in South Gaza, body bags are laid out in several rows. Zaki Shukba stands over clothes and bones, thought to be his nephew, 19-year-old Abd al-Salam. Zaki awaits the arrival of the boy's brother to confirm.
His family still doesn't know where he is, says Zaki. They still don't know until they can confirm it.
Abd al-Salam's brother Mohammed comes. He touches the clothes, the skull of his brother. In this way, the death of Abd al-Salam is confirmed. Uncle and brother walk away, trying to comfort each other. In the family video, to the sound of a popular song, Aya Aldaba, age 13, is blowing up a lilo at the edge of the sea in Gaza. A younger sister plays between the waves. Happy days before the war. Aya was shot in the chest, her family says, by an Israeli sniper near Gaza City at the start of the war. She was buried in the grounds of a school where they'd taken refuge. Then the family fled south. It was only with the ceasefire that relatives were able to check on the grave. Her mother, Lina, received shocking photographs.
I recognised her clothes. The dogs pulled at her. Half of her body was next to the grave and the other half was out of it. Her head was in one place, while her torn clothes were in another. We had wrapped her with a blanket when we buried her, and I used that to confirm it was her.
For Lina, there's grief without end and a question that has no answer, one that sits with so many parents who lost children in Gaza. What could they have done differently, the circumstances of the war being what they were? I couldn't take her from where she was buried, Lina says, before asking, where could I have taken her?
Fergal Keane reporting. Well, the current ceasefire in the Gaza Strip has meant that more aid can get in and aid workers are more able to reach people desperately in need. Médecins Sans Frontières teams had been providing healthcare in the Ministry of Health Emirati Hospital but were forced to flee there after continuous bombings and then a ground invasion in May last year. Nadia Abu Moula from MSF used to work in that hospital and yesterday she went back for the first time.
We couldn't even recognize the streets. When I arrived to Emirati, I couldn't like say this is Emirati hospital, like the street of Emirati hospital. And it was so sad to see if the hospital that brings life to earth was like totally empty, no signs of life, everything is totally destroyed. No words can describe the scenes we have witnessed today in Rafah City. I really feel bad. Near Emirati and Shabura, we could see the tanks moving, so even the sense of safety and security was not there.
Liz Alcock works with the Medical Aid for Palestinians charity, and she's currently in Khan Yunis. She told us more about her team's efforts to get aid through.
The amount of aid and the variety of aid is increasing and has increased massively in the last few days. But it's difficult to access. Some areas are easier than others in terms of the ability for us to distribute. But given the scale of need and the almost total destruction of critical infrastructure, it's really impossible to meet the needs of the population in a meaningful and sustainable way.
Yes, I mean, we've just been hearing there from our correspondent about families returning north and finding their neighbourhoods razed to the ground, just dust, effectively. Well, what kind of aid do people need there in terms of shelter? Because obviously it's cold temperatures there at the moment.
It is cold, and the majority of people who have been displaced, which is around 1.9 million, have been living in makeshift camps and tents for up to 15 months. For the vast majority, there really is nothing to return to. I have staff saying to me, even if I go and I pitch a tent on the rubble of my home, I want to go home.
You mentioned that there were some places that you were still having difficulty getting through to. What are those, and what are the conditions there?
So some of the team have gone on foot to areas that were previously inaccessible. We ourselves, actually, a couple of days ago, we're able to drive down the main road that sort of bisects the Gaza Strip, which we haven't been able to drive on for more than a year. And it's an absolute, the level of devastation is hard to express in words. I've heard words like apocalyptic, like it's like the whole life has been annihilated. I wouldn't say that, because there are people there. There are people who have been forced to create a life out of the remnants of this devastation, but it's extremely difficult. And we have entire communities and neighborhoods where, that, you know, not only the critical infrastructure has been destroyed, but any access links in and out of them have also been destroyed. So for those people to get access to assistance, very difficult. And for us to be able to access them also is difficult. The main difference being that we don't have to apply to the Israelis for permission to enter some areas like we did before. We don't have to wait for them to give us the green light.
And in terms of getting through medical aid and the conditions that people have been in, I mean, we've even heard stories that some young people, babies, were badly affected by hypothermia. Is that still happening?
It is still happening because, well, for two reasons. One is that because of the security checks on the Israeli side, a lot of critical medical equipment, supplies, it still needs to go through Israeli approval processes, which can take up to 3 months. The other is simply when aid comes in and when we're trying to pick it up, we have to distribute it in a way that is safe. And that is very, very difficult when there aren't any roads left, when we can't get fuel to be able to transport trucks, and when there are unexploded ordnance everywhere and that haven't been cleared yet. So we have to really weigh up the risks with the desperate need of people to be able to access that aid.
And that was Liz Alcock from the charity Medical Aid for Palestinians speaking to us a short time ago. Still to come, we'll hear how actor Adrian Brody drew from his family's own experiences for his role in the Oscar-nominated film The Brutalist.
It's an opportunity for me to honor my ancestral struggles, my mother and my grandparents' hardships and loss in fleeing Hungary in the 50s, and the details and hardships that they experienced that very much parallel the lived experience of my character.
More on that to come, and a reminder of our headlines. A BBC investigation into the deadliest single Israeli attack in the recent conflict with Hezbollah has found evidence that almost all the 73 people killed were Lebanese civilians, and a wave of Ukrainian drone attacks on Russia have damaged industrial sites, including at a microelectronics plant. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, at least 240 million children, that's one in seven worldwide, had their schooling disrupted last year due to Climate hazards, according to a new report published by the UN's children charity UNICEF, things like heat waves, cyclones, storms, floods, closed schools or disrupted teaching in 85 different countries, apparently South Asia was one of the region's worst affected. Well, we can speak now to James Elder from UNICEF, joining us live from New York. James, I think this is one of the first, if not the first, report of this nature ever put together. And what's striking is the number of countries where this has been a problem.
Well, exactly, Rebecca. I mean, heavily into South Asia, Afghanistan, Mozambique, the Philippines. Many of your listeners will, of course, remember about those floods that hit Italy and then, of course, later on Spain. So we're talking hundreds of millions of children, remembering, of course, that we've known for decades that investing in the education of children is the most cost-effective intervention because of all those long-term ripple effects. So this is not just something that's, you know, clearly right in principle to protect those most vulnerable, but in practice, you know, education, you have an immense impact on economic growth, on empowering families, breaking cycles of poverty, and yet here we are with overwhelming evidence on what needs to be done, and yet again, very little meaning action being taken. But the evidence is so very real, Rebecca, that this climate crisis is impacting children now.
Well, and as you mentioned there, affluent countries also affected. And we're reminded of those scenes from LA in recent weeks where the whole school was burnt to the ground, wasn't it? What kind of impact, though, does it have on children if they lose their school or can't go to school for any length of time? And are any particular children most affected?
It has an immense impact, as I say, given that the ability of education to spur economic growth, big picture, in a country or in a region or globally or just for that family. Every dollar spent yields higher returns than almost any other thing that a government or an aid agency can do. And at the same time, we know educated individuals, whether it's girls, and this particularly hurts girls, to your point, Rebecca, educated girls marry later, have babies later, or more, you know, have more education to help those children. So it is the antithesis of a cycle of poverty. And yet, it is girls who are often hit hardest. When these closures occur, and they are happening at a record level, girls often don't go to school. Schools are damaged, or the way to get to school is damaged. When girls in those environments then suddenly lose that golden access to education, we see spikes in things like child marriage. We see spikes in things like child labour. So yet again, not just the most vulnerable, but it's girls, Rebecca, that are disproportionately affected.
And so very briefly, I mean, is there anything that can be done relatively soon to make schools or education at least more resilient to things that cause this kind of damage?
Yeah, it's a great question. And many of your listeners will know the obvious things. Renewable energies, protect our ecosystems, you know, protect carbon sinks like forests, wetlands and oceans. These are overdue. And the Secretary General of the UN made clear that governments and big businesses are making promises and not holding them. In the shorter term, UNICEF does a huge amount about in terms of working with communities, trying to build schools back better, putting national climate plans in place. So there's a lot going on at a local level. But big picture, this climate crisis impacts everyone, some more severely than others right now. Okay. And those standard things that we know need to be done yesterday.
All right. Nice to speak to you. Thank you so much for coming on. That's James Elder there from UNICEF. Now, multi-Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Ed Sheeran has just become the first Western artist to perform in the Himalayan state of Bhutan. He's just taken to the stage, apparently, in the football stadium in Thimphu, the capital, following this local support act, Rebellions. There's a flavour of the concert, and it's all quite a big deal, really, because Bhutan generally avoids Western cultural influence, like fast food restaurants and coffee shop chains, and foreign tourists, apparently. It's one of the ways it protects its claim of having the happiest population in the world. For the details on the concert, I've been speaking to Joni Harrison, editor of Daily Bhutan newspaper.
This is the very first international concert. We are very happy to have Ed Sheeran in Thimphu. There was a pre-concert, which is kind of like an appreciation for all the other people who are working tonight, you know, to take care of the actual concert. But the whole town is just full of excitement about this concert. In fact, there was no one really paying attention to work. I couldn't get any emails done today.
So yes.
And 4 hours prior to the concert, people are already on the ground. They were queuing up. Some already reached the concert ground. So the stadium is expected to be at full capacity. I think capacity is 25, and I think we might just have the biggest crowd ever in Thimphu, Chimelangtang Stadium.
25,000. So just tell us, what is it about Ed Sheeran? Why him? Because Bhutan generally avoids everything Western and Western culture, doesn't it? So why Ed Sheeran?
I don't think Bhutan avoids Western culture. Although TV and internet arrived in 1999, which is probably the latest in all the countries. But pop culture, the Bhutanese are very in tune with pop culture, be it Western pop. We have Bhutanese who attend electronic music festivals. The Bhutanese bands are typically doing covers of Western pop music. So if you have the chance to come to Bhutan, you'll realize that, yes, Bhutan has their own local pop culture, Bhutanese songs, but they do listen to music from all over the world. Actually.
But in terms of actually having an artist visit, I mean, was the thought that Ed Sheeran wouldn't be a corrupting influence on the culture?
I don't think he'll be corrupting. I think music is in every Bhutanese sing and dance. That's part of their culture.
Okay, so there's a lot of excitement in the country about this concert. Tell us a bit more about the strategy of why it's being held now, though, because we understand the king has got ambitions to build a new city, a mindfulness city, which would be more open for tourists. Tell us about that.
Oh, that's correct. The king has identified an area, a piece of land about four times the size of Singapore, to build the Gelifu Mindfulness City that is infused with spirituality and mindfulness to attract like-minded businesses and entrepreneurs and citizens to come and work from this city. All right. And this will be in the 5 to 10 years time, this will be a new gateway to Bhutan. Mm. So that Bhutan will be even more connected to the world through these new efforts.
So Bhutanese people are often considered to be the happiest on earth, aren't they? Something about the culture and the way of life. What do you think the rest of us could learn in terms of the approach to life that might make us all a bit happier?
I think the Bhutanese belief is very much rooted in spirituality. All right. Of course, the medium that they use to reach spirituality is Buddhism, which happens to be prolific throughout the kingdom. Bhutanese are naturally very spiritual. It's got to do with the land, that they respect every part of the land, be it the water, be it the trees, be it the rocks. These are all entire environment in Bhutan is respected by the people.
Joni Harrison there, editor of the Daily Bhutan newspaper, on Ed Sheeran in Bhutan.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Father Pierre Bazile says that he was just 12 years of age when he knew he wanted to live a religious life. And today he's been living in a silent monastery for 45 years. Hear his story.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. The Oscar nominations are out and the film The Brutalist has landed 10 nominations, including for Best Film. It tells the tale of a Hungarian-born architect and Holocaust survivor who works on a vast project for a wealthy US industrialist. Our entertainment correspondent Lizo Mazimba has been speaking to the cast of the film.
There was a war on, and yet many of the sites of my projects had survived.
Post-war America and Hungarian immigrant Laszlo is trying to rebuild his life through his work as an architect. He's played by Oscar winner Adrian Brody, who says Laszlo's drive to create resonates with his own journey as an actor.
Any artistic person, I think, can relate to the struggle and yearnings to leave, create a body of work and leave behind something of great meaning.
And how much did you delve into your own personal family history to inform this role?
It's an opportunity for me to honour my ancestral struggles, my mother and my grandparents' hardships and loss in fleeing Hungary in the 50s, and the details and hardships that they experienced that very much parallel the lived experience of my character.
A personal journey then for Adrian Brody, for Felicity Jones, who plays his wife.
That's fine. Just fine. Feel free to call me Elizabeth.
She'd long been searching for roles where she wasn't just a weak offshoot of her husband, but was an independent, intelligent woman.
Where?
Oxford. To study English.
Yeah, I mean, I spend most of my life foraging through scripts, trying to find decent characters to play. I mean, that's a huge part of it. So I've got to find someone who has some kind of spunk, or, you know, has some fight in them, some sense of defiance is so key. So when I read the script, it was an absolute no-brainer. I thought, this woman is tremendous. But I mean, they're few and far between, for sure, you know. When you get something like this, you just grab it with both hands.
They do not want us here.
Who do you mean?
The people here. They do not want us here.
The relationships in the film are personal and intimate, set against a backdrop that is epic in so many ways, not least the film's length. Its running time is more than 3.5 hours.
Did not realize these images were still available, much less of any consequence.
The film gathered 10 Oscar nominations, including a Best Actor nod for Adrian Brody. Even before they were announced, Brody said how thankful he was for the recognition the film has gained.
I'm just really grateful. I'm very appreciative of having had a chance to flourish in a work that I've dedicated a life towards. And when that is received with respect and appreciation, it's very rewarding.
In just over a month's time, Adrian Brody will find out if he's won a second Best Actor Oscar, as well as whether the film has won Best Picture.
Lizo Mazimba with that report. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Another day, another stream of directives from the new US President Donald Trump. For a full list, do go to the BBC News website for more details on those you're particularly interested in. Today, we're focusing on one executive order signed by Mr. Trump that demands the declassification of all secret files relating to the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy in 1963, his brother Senator Bobby Kennedy in 68, and civil rights leader Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, also killed in 1968. All three men were found to have been shot by fanatical lone gunmen, but for decades many have suspected other people may have been involved. President Trump said it was time. It was in the public domain.
That's a big one, huh? A lot of people are waiting for this for a long, for years, for decades. And everything will be revealed.
There he is, signing it there. Well, President Kennedy was shot while travelling in an open-top car in Dallas, Texas, his wife Jackie by his side. The moment was captured by TV cameras and the confusing aftermath broadcast on live radio.
The president's car is now going past me. The limousine is now travelling at a very high rate of speed. Secret Service men standing up in the limousine. They are armed with submachine guns. It appears as though someone in the limousine might have been hit by the gunfire.
Well, similarly, the assassination of President Kennedy's brother, Bobby, was also filmed. In 2022, I interviewed Paul Schrade, who was a close friend and campaigner on RFK's team. He was standing next to RFK and was also shot that night, but he survived. He died a few months after I spoke to him, but he never believed the theory that the man arrested for it, Sirhan Sirhan, was a lone gunman. He told me me there was evidence that at least one other person was involved.
They still say Sirhan is a lone gunman, when he was not the lone gunman, based upon their own evidence. The bullets taken from Kennedy were from a different gun by a different gunman with different bullets than Sirhan was firing. The second gunman had fired off four bullets behind Kennedy at a very close range, at point-blank range. So two different guns, two different bullets, two different shooters. But we could never convince any district attorney or any police chief to reopen the case. It's been covered up and hidden for all this time.
Well, let's get a view now with Gerald Posner, who's a writer and the author of Case Closed, which is a 1993 book that concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald did kill President Kennedy on his own. He also wrote a book about the assassination of Martin Luther King. Gerald, thanks for coming on the programme. What's your view on Mr. Trump's move then? Will it end the speculation once and for all?
I don't think it will end it, Rebecca. I mean, this speculation, people believing it's a conspiracy, will go on far beyond the release of the documents. But I'm glad that Trump finally did it. You know, he had an opportunity to do it the way that American law was crafted back in his first term, because the deadline for releasing these 3,000 or so documents that are still sealed at the National Archives came up to him. And he said, I'll do it. And then he changed his mind. But this time he came through. RFK Jr. has had a big influence on him, and I think that Trump followed through on his promise. In typical Trump style, in the clip you played, he said everything will be revealed. We'll have to wait and see. We're a few weeks away from finding out the first parts of those releases, but I hope so.
Yeah, RFK Jr., of course, is Mr. Trump's pick for the health minister, isn't he? And it was his father, Bobby, and his uncle, John F.K., that was killed there. I mean, each of these cases are so complex, aren't they? Do you believe that all the documents will be intact? And will people believe that they're intact?
Yeah, I think they will be intact. And I actually think there will be some news in there for those of us who have been researching the case or for historians. I'm looking to find information that the CIA might have known more about Lee Harvey Oswald, the person who was then that I think also killed the president. When he went to Mexico City only 6 weeks before the assassination, tried to get to Cuba, but was turned down by the Soviet and the Cuban missions there. CIA had surveillance. They might have picked up evidence of how unhinged and explosive Oswald was. He smashed his revolver down at a table in front of KGB agents in Mexico City. And if they did, they never reported any of that to the FBI when Oswald re-entered the country only a month and a half before Kennedy's motorcade was in Dallas. So this would be terribly embarrassing to the CIA, and it should be public. But it's not going to reveal what I think many people in the public are looking for, which is a X-Files moment, a single document that says, here are the conspirators. Here's how the deep state killed Kennedy and RFK and MLK. There's not that document that's waiting to be unearthed in these 3,000 remaining files.
You say that there could be some embarrassment for the government or government agencies. And I suppose that might explain why successive presidents and governments have been reluctant to release these files. But certainly there is sort of a united idea across the political divide, isn't there, that this should be in the public domain? It's one thing that may unite people, actually.
Absolutely. I think people will be united on that, and they should have been for a long time. You know, many of these documents over there that have been partially released have redactions where the government just blocks out information. Many of them, literally dozens and dozens, the only thing that's blocked out is a social security number of the individual who's talked about, the equivalent of your national insurance number. We don't make those public most of the time. In other instances, there are tax files. There are the tax files of Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby, the nightclub owner who killed Oswald 2 days after he was arrested. We don't release tax files normally, but this is an extraordinary case. The American public and people in other countries have a right to know what the government knew about this assassination and the other murders of Bobby Kennedy and MLK as well.
Well, yes, certainly on the case of Martin Luther King, I mean, that's seen as one of the most consequential assassinations, isn't it, of that period. And his family have had major questions to ask. They do think there's been a conspiracy there.
Right. And I understand why they believe that, because Martin Luther King was targeted by the government, by the FBI, illegally. They had surveillance on him. They did everything they could to ruin his reputation. So when he was killed, by this, a convict who was out of prison and on the run, who I believe did it for money, for a bounty from a racist in the Midwest of America, was offering up to $50,000 on King's head. I think that was the small conspiracy. But the family says it has to be more than that. And one of the things about the MLK files that President Trump may not know is that it was the Congressional Black Caucus in the late 70s that asked for many of the King files to stay sealed in the government because it included the FBI illegal surveillance that was on his private life, and they didn't want that out. They has nothing to do with the assassination, and those should not be public.
We must leave it there, but lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much for coming on. That's Gerald Posner there. To Kenya next, where last year there were a series of mass demonstrations against the government plans to raise taxes. Because many of the protesters were young, they became known as Gen Z protests. Many were arrested, but there were also allegations of dozens of illegal abductions. Police have denied any involvement, but now a judge in Kenya has warned he'll imprison the police chief for contempt of court this Monday if he fails for a third time to show up and account for a recent string of alleged disappearances. Our Africa correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher reports on the backlash.
At the height of Kenya's Gen Z protests, police struck hard at demonstrators angered by tax hikes and corruption. Dozens were arrested, but many disappeared.
This is the place where the abduction happened.
We are standing at the end of the alleyway down which your house is located, yes. Right where the road, where it joins the road.
Yes, this is the exact point where we abducted. They were surveilling our mobile phones, they were tracking us down, but our house is just...
Jamil Longton's brother, Aslam, was one of the protest organizers. He'd been warned to stop. Both were pulled into a car outside their home, hooded and handcuffed. After that, there was no sign of them for 32 days. Aslam tells me he was regularly beaten, his tormentor demanding to know who was funding the protests. They were held in small dark cells, they said, in an unknown location.
Who abducted you? Do you know who abducted you?
They were heavily armed. They did the abduction in plain daylight. So you see, the security agents had, they knew what was going on. They had the tracking devices that could track down our mobile phones. I don't know if anybody is capable of doing that in this country, apart from the security agencies.
Others like them were captured on camera. This is a victim filmed with a phone, screaming as he tries to fight off abductors. More than 80 government critics have been reported missing so far, about a third still unaccounted for.
I have personally served as my son was abducted and disappeared, and I was not sure whether he was alive or dead.
A damning indictment from this government minister, Justin Muturi. He says his son was picked up by the National Intelligence Service and only released after Mr. Muturi made a direct appeal to the president, William Ruto.
That is a matter of investigation because that is his side of the story, right? But what is a counter story of the National Intelligence Service?
The government spokesman, Isaac Mwaura, declined to comment on the case.
I would want to say categorically that the President of the Republic of Kenya, who is the head of government, has not sanctioned any forms of abduction whatsoever, because he is a man who believes in the rule of law.
But Kenya has a history of state-sponsored abductions, especially in the 1980s and 90s, under the authoritarian leader Daniel Arap Moi.
This kid being arrested and locked away is an exact replica of what Moi used to do.
Getobu Imenyara is a lawyer and democracy activist. He was arrested and beaten by Moi's regime. He has no doubt he's seeing the so-called Moi playbook in action now. But he says times have changed.
Internal pressure is so much now. The government can no longer ignore the voices of its own citizens. And I think that that's the main difference between this period and that time when democratic institutions were non-existent. Now we have a media that is very free in comparative terms. Members of the public are recording these clips and sharing them almost instantaneously.
The Inspector General of Police misses on that third hearing date. I will cite, convict, and sentence on the spot. With respect,
there is more accountability now. This judge has summoned the police chief to court three times, but he hasn't shown up yet.
He's denied involvement, but no one else has been charged, let alone convicted. President Ruto has promised to stop the abductions, forced to respond to public outrage and to concern from Western allies. He can rally a crowd of supporters, but many Kenyans are waiting to see whether the country has really moved on from its dark past.
That report from our Africa correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher in Nairobi there. Stay with us, more to come from NewsHour. And a reminder of our top story this hour. The current ceasefire in the Gaza Strip has meant that more aid can now get through, more aid workers able to reach people desperately in need. Liz Alcock is from the aid agency Medical Aid for Palestinians. She told us how Gazans are desperate to get home despite the appalling conditions.
For the vast majority, there really is nothing to return to. And I have staff saying to me, even if I go and I pitch a tent on the rubble of my home, I want to go home.
Other headlines, a BBC investigation into the deadliest single Israeli attack in the recent conflict with Hezbollah has found evidence that almost all of the 73 people killed were Lebanese civilians. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, a small Chinese startup called DeepSeek recently unveiled a new AI system that could match the capabilities of cutting-edge chatbots from companies like OpenAI and Google. Not only that, but their engineers say that they used only a fraction of the highly specialised and expensive computer chips to train their systems. So what does all this mean to US tech giants and the incoming Trump administration? Let's speak live now to Gary Marcus, who's a leading expert on AI and the author of Taming Silicon Valley, How We Can Ensure That AI Works for Us. Gary, welcome to the programme. So first of all, what's so special about what this Chinese firm has managed to do?
I think what's special about it is how cheaply they did it. They built large language models, which is the kind of technology most people are using for AI these days, but at a much, much smaller budget than other people did recently. And they did it with less GPUs, and high-end GPUs, which a kind of computer chip, have become limited in their export by the United States. And so they found a way to do this without requiring the things that were on the kind of banned chip list. So it has both technical ramifications because they can do things more efficiently than before, and it has geopolitical implications because one way in which the US was trying to keep China behind is no longer really going to work.
Right, yes, because there'd been that chip export control, hasn't there? So really, actually, that's helped the innovation of this Chinese company.
That's right. This is a kind of case of necessity as the mother of invention. They couldn't get their hands on the same chips that other people were using, so they found a more efficient and pretty clever way of doing things that wouldn't require those chips.
I mentioned the new Trump administration, and he's been very open about how he would like the United States to be dominant in AI and that sort of whole industry coming in. What stage are we at with the industrial race to control and develop AI?
My opinion is that large language models, which are popular, are overrated and that they have a lot of technical limitations. They hallucinate, they make silly errors. But to the extent that that is the best technology we have available, the race is very, very tight right now. I wouldn't say that America is dominant. I would say they're in the lead, but China is doing very similar things. This paper by DeepSeek, or actually a couple of papers, these papers by DeepSeek are very impressive. Neither country has a clear advantage. So it costs a lot of money to build of these things, less now given the new paper. So even more people can get in the mix. There's no clear dominance. When somebody comes up with a new idea right now, everybody's working the same general sphere of ideas. And that means that new innovations can be copied very quickly. So nobody's going to be, you know, very far ahead of anybody else unless there's a fundamentally really different kind of innovation, which might happen, but we don't know when that might happen or who will do it.
And very briefly, all of this is a very lucrative industry going forward, I guess.
Maybe. You know, people put an enormous amount in hundreds of billions of dollars, but the actual revenue has only been on the order of $5 or $10 billion. That goes back, I think, to the unreliability. Unless that reliability problem can be solved, then many companies use it as a proof of concept and aren't really fully satisfied with it. So the actual rollout of generative AI has been less than people have expected. And so far, it's a net loss. That could change, but I wouldn't be certain that it will be lucrative.
Interesting. Thank you so much for joining us live. That's Gary Marcus there. Now, hair loss is incredibly common, mostly though it's not exclusively in men, and apparently if you're white you're slightly more likely to have it by the age of 50, but it is really common and natural in all ethnicities. Some men do try to keep it at bay with hair loss drugs, but now the BBC has found that some online sites are prescribing the drug finasteride without consistent safety checks, and in a small number of men it can cause serious side effects including depression, fatigue, and also loss of sexual function. Well, concerns about the drug are not new. In the United States, the FDA has updated the labelling for potential side effects, including to suicidal ideation. Well, I've been speaking to Kyle. He doesn't want us to use his last name. He's from Wakefield in Yorkshire, England, and he told me he continues to suffer side effects even long after stopping taking the medication. So why did he start using it to begin with?
Knew a mate who'd been on it for a while. He was fine and it was working good for his hair. And they all started popping up all over Facebook and that. Like, I'd get a few comments on my hair from my mates and that, and I thought, oh, I'll just research into it. So I started watching a lot of videos. They all say it's safe, like it's safe to take. If you experience any side effects, just stop it and they'll go away. So I kind of thought I may as well just try it then.
And so did you send away to get it online, or did you go to your general practitioner to talk about it?
No, I just ordered it online, which looking back is kind of stupid of me. I should have gone to doctor for his advice as well, but I just went on an online and ordered it on there, and someone, I don't know who, said it was okay and sent it to my door.
And so what was the first that you realised that you were getting side effects?
About 3 weeks to a month in, I started experiencing a bit of low mood, depression and some sexual issues.
At the time, did you tie that to taking this drug, or did you think other reasons could be behind that?
The low mood and that, I just thought maybe I'm just a bit tired and that. But when the sexual issues started kicking in, I thought it's a common side effect of the drug, so I thought it's got to be that. So I just stopped it, hoping everything could just go back to normal, and yeah, it never has.
Right, so it's had long-term impacts.
Yeah, it's been like 7 months now, something like that, and I'm still dealing with issues and even more issues after stopping. They do warn of the side effects, but like, there's no big mention of them persisting after they've stopped the drug.
And how are these long-term effects, what kind of impact is that having on your normal life?
Oh, it's terrible. It's affected my quality of life so much. Like, it's just, it's basically zero. It's awful. I just can't live my normal life at all.
What would you say needs to happen as a result of what you've found out and what others have been saying as well?
There just needs to be more awareness of persistent side effects. You shouldn't be able to get the drug just by ordering it online. I think you definitely need to talk with a doctor, whether that's in person or on Zoom call, so you're made more of aware of the actual risks of taking it. I think a doctor should definitely have to talk to you before getting it.
In terms of, you know, hair loss, it's so common, isn't it? I mean, so many men have that issue, some women as well, but it's mainly a male thing. Has all of this kind of changed your view on how you feel about that now?
I'd shave, I'd give all my hair today just to be back to normal. Like, it's just, it's such a minor problem. I feel stupid now. You're your own worst enemy sometimes. You have these, you get in your own head thinking, oh, I want to keep my hair and that. I don't like how it looks, but it's just every man deals with it and it's just part of life. It's not something you should have to medicate for.
And that was Kyle, one man who says he's had some difficulties with that drug there. That's it for this hour. The news is up next.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Father Pierre Bazile says that he was just 12 years of age when he knew he wanted to live a religious life. And today he's been living in a silent monastery for 45 years. Hear his story.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.